Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the best parts of a talk given by civil liberties activist Paul Siegel. Siegel focuses on gay rights. I think that subject is interesting in its own right, and I think his ideas apply also to people in many other groups whose freedom has been infringed by those in power. I hope you'll stay tuned. Paul Siegel's day job is professor of communication at the University of Hartford. He gave an hour-long illustrated public lecture at the university on April 27. He brought with him a gazillion dollars worth of way cool portable video recording equipment and a crew of 8 students to operate it. I felt like quite the Luddite arriving with nothing more than a geriatric laptop computer and a bag of cables and connectors to plug it into the PA system. But it worked. Siegel discusses a lot of interesting incidents and interesting court cases where gay people have fought discrimination against them. Many cases have been fought on 14th Amendment grounds, specifically on that amendment's rights of equal protection and the right of privacy. Siegel thinks, in many instances, it's better to base an anti-discrimination suit on the First Amendment. The First Amendment guarantees, among other rights, freedom of speech, and the right to assemble to petition the government for redress of grievances. Discrimination against gays can take many forms, but a large amount of that discrimination arguably infringes one of the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. Here are selections from Paul Siegel's talk, which is titled, Gay Rights as a Free Speech Issue.
Why is this a free speech issue, as opposed to other kinds of legal theories we could invoke to talk about the gay rights movement? Well, one reason is because we think of gay people, unlike those of most other minority groups, as appropriately being termed the invisible minority. Now, people joke about having gaydar, but the fact is that you can't always tell one by looking at one. And for many queer folks, therefore, to suffer negative consequences requires coming out in some way in advance of suffering those consequences. So, for example, if these people get fired for marching in a political rally, if any political activism comes to the attention of one's employer, we have a free speech issue. If these people lose their kids or suffer some kind of discrimination in custody court because of their activism, we have a freedom of speech, freedom of association issue. We also see that queer political groups have often had to go to court to win recognition or tax-exempt status or receive university funding. Again, clear free speech and freedom of association issues are going on here. Clearly, one of the best examples of why it's a free speech issue is this whole notion of don't ask, don't tell. Now, the old we don't want no queers policy could be seen more plausibly as an equal protection issue, but the current status of the law is clearly, at its core, a free speech issue. So one reason for seeing queer rights as a free speech issue is the notion of gays' invisible status, but there are other reasons. The traditional arguments against homosexuality, that it's unnatural, that gays are sick, that they are a danger to children, etc., no longer seem tenable to educated individuals. So anti-gay prejudice is often manifested as negative reactions to what might very well be called a gay sensibility. Translated into First Amendmentese, this would be called viewpoint-based discrimination. David Richards, who is a law professor at NYU, has said that homosexuality is today essentially a form of political, social, and moral dissent on a par with the best American traditions of dissent and even subversive advocacy. Those who oppose gay rights find today in homosexuality what they found before in the family planning of Sanger, in the atheism of Darwin, in the socialism of Eugene Debs, and in the Marxist advocacy of the American Communist Party. Much social science research shows that anti-gay attitudes correlate with an adherence to highly traditional sex roles, and the view that gays are sex role heretics, the notion that gay men want to be women, that lesbians want to be men. This is sometimes called the sexual inversion hypothesis. This dynamic also explains why anti-gay prejudice tends to be most virulent, counterintuitively perhaps, against gay males, and especially gay males who do not look especially gay. Yet a third reason for studying the queer movement as a free speech movement is one of practicality. Plainly put, gay litigants have tended to win more frequently when they can plausibly raise First Amendment arguments. Equal protection arguments usually do not work, because to win in this domain, your group almost has to be defined as a suspect class, which sounds like something you wouldn't want to be, but actually in 14th Amendment law, you want very much to be deemed a suspect class, and we have not been deemed a suspect class, and so we find it difficult to win on equal protection grounds. There are some ironies as to how this comes about. Gay people are seen as not powerless enough, perhaps not immutable enough to be a member of a suspect class. And so people may discriminate against gays almost with impunity as long as they have even the smallest hint of a rational reason for doing so. The courts have similarly rejected the privacy rationale, finding that there is no fundamental right, again, 14th Amendment language, to have a same-sex partner. Now, we do have a fundamental right to decide whether or not to have a baby. It would be interesting to see what might happen if a future litigant were to argue that his or her choice of a same-sex partner was made precisely to avoid procreation. But I know of no such case. By contrast, First Amendment arguments often have worked. They're not fail-safe, mind you. They just have a better track record. And so we look at our roadmap. We're going to look first at the pure cases, the access to a forum cases, the access to a message cases, and then we're going to look at freedom of association, a phrase we've already used, and we're going to look at political associations and more apolitical, purely social associations, and finally we're going to take a look at symbolic conduct, behavior that functions as speech. We're not going to have time for everything. And some things we're not going to have time for but would be fun to talk about would be employment law. General rule in America, in fact, it's called the American rule, not something to be proud of, is that you can get fired for pretty much any reason whatsoever in this country. And the civil rights bill that might become the Civil Rights Act, sometimes called ENDA, Employment Non-Discrimination Act, languishes in various congressional committees. We're not going to have a chance to talk about libel and invasion of privacy, and I grieve a little bit about this because it means we're not going to talk about such folks as Madonna, who had a, yes, I know, who had an interesting libel suit, but it'll be beyond our scope tonight. We're not going to get to talk about solicitation, what might be called the Lady Marmalade doctrine, you know, voulez-vous coucher avec moi and all that stuff. But hey, you can practice that on your own. You don't need me. And we're not going to talk much about sodomy itself, at least in the sense of sodomy court cases, although sodomy rears its, I can't say ugly head, it rears its head frequently in First Amendment case law. Suffice it to say for our purposes that in the 1980s we lost a sodomy case, and a few years ago we won the sodomy case, and those weren't argued on First Amendment grounds. We won on equal protection grounds, but a very weakened version of equal protection argument. Some of my favorite cases have had to do with the Yellow Pages, and a number of these come out of California. In this particular case, Council on Religion and the Homosexual versus Pacific Telephone and Telegraph, the group had already had a display under religious organizations, but wanted to have a new category, homophile organizations, created for them instead. The phone company refused. The category was too narrow, and besides, homophiles not even in the dictionary. Now, the Public Utilities Commission, the PUC, upheld the phone company, so we lost this case. There was, however, a delightful dissenting opinion from one of the commissioners, part of which I'd like to share with you. PT&T has no objective criteria by which to determine whether or not a heading is too limited. Such decisions are capricious and dictated by the whims, prejudices, or vagaries of an individual or individuals in PT&T's directory sales department. For example, the PT&T directory sales supervisor testified that he would not approve a separate classification heading for clarinets, as he felt such a listing really belonged under the heading of musical instruments. He was unable to adequately explain, however, why violins, accordions, and pianos were permitted separate classifications. Furthermore, the majority's attempt, continuing with this commissioner here, to hide behind the fortress of Webster is futile. It is true, as they point out, that the word homophile does not appear in Webster's third New International Dictionary. On the other hand, neither does Scientology or personology, both of which have headings in the current San Francisco Yellow Page section. Remember, this was California, after all. Next case, also Yellow Page, is also California, Society for Individual Rights versus Public Utilities Commission. Now, in this particular case, the phone company admitted that it found the ad offensive. And again, the public utility, the ad just said this. And then gave an address and a phone number, for heaven's sakes. And again, the Public Utilities Commission upheld the company, and the same commissioner offered an equally eloquent dissenting opinion. My view, he said, that PT&T has no reasonable standards by which it measures good taste can perhaps be best illustrated by comparing the innocuous little preferred ad here with those which PT&T has published and which presumably have met its lofty standards. One advertisement in the San Francisco telephone book issued in September 1970 is for a nightclub which features topless and bottomless nude girls in the bedroom. And another tastefully advertises that it features topless, bottomless gun malls and has nightly rate. No, I wasn't going to have a topless, bottomless one there. You know. For music lovers, another club advertises with illustration that it has a nude girl on the piano. Again, you'll have to use your imagination for that one. Out of deference to, this will sound sexist, but remember it's the times, out of deference to the wives of America, I have avoided outlining the details of 6 pages of massage parlor advertisements. Well, we know things have changed, obviously. Not only are queer groups able to reach mainstream audiences in the Yellow Pages and similar outlets these days, but the larger trend contemporaneously is for mainstream corporations to include gay audiences as an important target in their marketing campaigns. And it's not just for liquor. This particular photo collage comes from PayPal, for example. Not a particular case I'm going to talk about here, but just a pattern in the law that lasted for just a few years. For a few years in the 1960s, it appeared that gay porn was more protected than straight porn. There was a loophole involved here. The Supreme Court's definition of obscenity included the notion, as it still does, that obscene works, to be obscene, have to appeal to your prurient interest, the prurient interest of the average community member. Well, a number of gay litigants pointed out that the average community member is straight, and the average community member, therefore, will not be turned on by gay porn, so we win. And the court said, oops, you're right, until the Supreme Court said, well, we got to fix this, and so we'll fine-tune that opinion, that definition, to say that you can take into account the turn-on factor for the target audience, not just the average community member. There have been a number of cases, including a famous Supreme Court case involving lobbying and the portion of the First Amendment, the last part of the First Amendment, sometimes called the Petition Clause, that says that you have the right not only to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, but to assemble peacefully to petition the government for redress of grievances. Well, the famous case was Evans versus Romer. Colorado had passed an amendment to its state constitution that did this. It had this wording. Neither the state of Colorado, through any of its branches or departments, nor any of its agencies, political divisions, municipalities, or school districts, shall enact, adopt, or enforce any statute, regulation, ordinance, or policy whereby homosexual, lesbian, or bisexual orientation, conduct, practices, or relationships shall constitute or otherwise be the basis of or entitle any person or class of persons to have or claim any minority status, quota preferences, protected status, or claim of discrimination. In other words, it got rid of of, in one fell swoop, all the local civil rights ordinances that had been passed in the more liberal communities in Colorado, and also said, as a matter of state constitutional law, nobody may ever pass such a law again. And the reason this has clear petition clause implications is because gay people were being told, you can petition the government as much as you want, but your state representative will not be allowed to pass a law on your behalf. The Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, struck down this law. Now, it did so on this state constitutional amendment. It did so on 14th Amendment grounds, but I think you'll agree it has strong petition clause elements when I read this section. Central both to the idea of the rule of law and to our own Constitution's guarantee of equal protection is the principle that government and each of its parts remain open on impartial terms to all who seek its assistance. A law declaring that in general it shall be more difficult for one group of citizens than for all others to seek aid from the government is itself a denial of equal protection of the laws in the most literal sense. There was a case involving AIDS protesters at the Pennsylvania State Legislature, and when they were thrown out of the hall and they went to court, here's what the court says. That plaintiff's members would be engaging in protected communicative activity is clear. One need not speak to make a point. While simply attending the speech and making themselves known through their presence is itself communicative in nature, the ACT-UP members' message could go beyond that. According to testimony at the hearing, most of the members who were barred access to the gallery were dressed in colorful garb with the words ACT-UP clearly written on the front. Thus, they would make their presence known not only as citizens in attendance, but also as members of ACT-UP, who would presumably be scrutinizing the Commonwealth's response to the AIDS crisis. By the way, I should point out that virtually every case I'm talking about tonight, the ACLU was involved in one way or another, typically at the appellate level. And if that's an organization that you have fond feelings for, you may have noticed or can notice on your way out that they have a table that they will have staffed, and they would love to talk to you, and I'm sure they would be all too happy to take your money.
We're listening to civil liberties activist Paul Siegel on New World Notes. We're hearing portions of his recent public lecture, Gay Rights as a Free Speech Issue. If you've just tuned in, I'll note that whether you're gay, straight, or whatever, the old wobbly cry still rings true. An injury to one is an injury to all. And lots of people and lots of other groups experience the same denial of constitutionally protected civil liberties. If they can get away with pulling these stunts on gay people and establish legal precedent for doing so, rest assured that you are next on their list. Back to Paul Siegel.
There have been a number of high school cases, too, and these high school cases tend to have been based on the Equal Access Act of 1984, which ironically was passed in order to protect the rights of religious Christian groups, because so many public high schools and elementary schools, too, would be afraid of letting any prayer activity go on, student-initiated prayer or religious activity of any kind. So, oh, no, we can't do this because another part of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, says we can't let you do that in school. And so this was Congress's way of saying, nah, we think you're misinterpreting that part of the First Amendment. And the way the Equal Access Act reads, it basically says that any school that has any extracurricular activities, truly extracurricular, cannot discriminate on the basis of religion or politics in deciding which groups get funded, which groups get recognized, etc. And so court cases have had to deal with things like if you have a synchronized swim team, is that curricular or extracurricular? If you have a cheerleading team, if you have a chess team, is that curricular or extracurricular? And as you can imagine, it depends upon how you frame the issue. Well, we certainly teach swimming, but we don't teach synchronized swimming. We certainly have a lot of athletic teams and we teach a lot of PE courses, but we didn't really have a cheerleading course. And so the courts ruled that these were extracurricular, therefore you couldn't discriminate against the gay group. Very recent case out of Florida involves a high school where it has a gay-straight alliance, and the high school administration wants the Gay Straight Alliance to change its name to something less seemingly contradictory of the school's sexual abstinence policies. For example, why don't you just call yourselves the Tolerance Club? A federal district court ruled for the students and had this to say. The students testified that the proposed name change would attack the very core reason for having the club. A student testified that he does not even like the word tolerance because it is not as affirming as the word alliance or acceptance. To him, tolerance means to put up with, in the sense that Jews and blacks used to be put up with until they were finally accepted. The board's suggested name change would indicate a club that is not only more general than the one he wants, but also a club that merely promotes tolerance far less than he hopes to achieve. Another recent case, also out of Florida, high school wanted to punish an 11th grader for violating rules that prohibited wearing T-shirts or buttons with rainbows, pink triangles, or such slogans as equal, not special rights, gay, fine by me, gay pride, I support my gay friends, etc. This was a very easy case, so there were no fun quotes to get from it, actually. It was just one of those where you think you would just have had to write a letter, but the school district decided to go to court and lose. A number of state universities have flirted with and have passed campus hate speech codes. Wherever these codes have been challenged in court, talking about public universities now, not private universities, they've been struck down. And so most of the incidents we see around the country every year are just that, incidents that typically don't get to court. And one of the most provocative ones that I recall was one back at Illinois State University, one of the other places I used to teach. What would you do with a student who hangs a banner outside of his dormitory room that says exactly this, AIDS kills fags dead? Well, yeah, it's a powerful kind of message, AIDS kills fags dead. I guess a language philosopher would have a field day with it, linguists would have field days with it. What is the real message going on here? I suspect it's something like AIDS kills fags dead, comma, and I think that's a nice thing. I suppose that's what's going on, and it's the I think that's a nice thing part of the message, the unspoken part of the message that people get upset by. But if you take just the factual content of the banner, isn't this the exact same message that AIDS activists had been trying to get Congress and state legislatures to understand for years and years? Well, maybe they wouldn't have used such emotional language in this way, but that's the message. It's killing us. It's killing us. Do something about it. So difficult kinds of issues, and I imagine some of those have happened on this campus from time to time. We've talked about political associations, but there are also non-political associations. The earliest cases involved gay bars, and there was a case from New Jersey in which you were not allowed to serve alcohol to persons of ill repute. The court decided we couldn't figure out if gay people were of ill repute or not. It's kind of vague, so we have to strike down that regulation. My favorite part of the statute, or rather of the court case, is that the judge quotes from an undercover cop and his testimony. It reads like a ethnography. I was going to say freshman ethnography, but that would be insulting to freshmen. They were conversing, and some of them in a lisping tone of voice. And during certain parts of their conversations, they used limp wrist movements to each other. One man would stick his tongue out at another, and they would laugh, and they would giggle. They were very, very chummy and close. When they drank their drinks, they extended their pinkies in a very dainty manner. They took short sips. Child custody is a freedom of association issue, certainly. Sometimes overnight visitation is predicated on there being no other gay people in the household during the visit. I suppose the weirdest cases are those in which grandparents win custody. You know, think of the irony here. You've got the court being concerned about the danger of raising gay kids, and so they give custody to the one group of litigants who have a track record of raising gay kids.
At this point, Siegel plays a video produced by the ACLU about a high school student in Southern California. She's Vietnamese by way of ancestry, articulate, and, unknown to her parents, gay. She was caught kissing her girlfriend on school grounds. For this crime against chastity and good order, she was suspended, denied membership in the National Honor Society, and outed to her parents by the school principal. The girl's sister states that heterosexual kissing on school grounds is endemic and ignored by the authorities.
My name is Charlene Wan. I went to high school in Orange County, California. Not that long ago, my main concerns were doing my homework and getting into a good college. However, I began having feelings for my best friend, Trang. We started dating, which made me very happy. But after a while, something terrible began to happen. Kids got suspended for vandalizing, starting fights. I got in trouble for kissing my girlfriend. And I just think that's really bizarre and, you know, unfair. Well, I just loved my girlfriend. I didn't think there would be any harm in, you know, being affectionate. I didn't think that it was a crime. It's very common to see that kind of behavior around high school. Even my sister said that, you know, she used to make out with her boyfriend and she never got in trouble for it back in high school. Students never showed any hatred or disgust in us showing affection. I think they got used to it, or they just accepted that we're who we are. We thought that the teachers would be more supportive. The reality of it was that nobody openly supported us. They were all afraid to lose their jobs, and teachers do have their biases, their prejudices.
Charlene and her girlfriend were suspended.
I just felt like I was being punished for being who I was, or am. And it just made me feel a lot of self-deprecation.
Charlene's invitation to the National Honor Society was revoked.
My homeroom teacher who got it, she called up the teacher who sent the invitation and said that I shouldn't get it because I had a disciplinary record, so she threw it in the trash.
The principal outed Charlene to her family.
My mom just, like, when I saw her, when she came to pick me up in the office, her eyes were teary, and I was crying because I didn't know how she would react. I was afraid. I didn't want her to stop loving me, and I didn't know if she told my dad or anything like that, so it was all a big shock. I don't think any principal has the right to, out a student to their parents because they don't know how the family is. They don't know the consequences or whether or not they'd be supportive or, you know, kick them out of the house. It's not right.
The ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of Charlene to protect her rights.
We're all just normal people, and I just want to see the discrimination stop.
For more information about my case and others, please visit the American Civil Liberties Union website. You can also learn how your own story can make a difference.
In this talk, we have looked at the philosophical and pragmatic justifications for treating the queer rights movement as a First Amendment phenomenon. Gay litigants do not always win, even when they do have plausible free speech interests in their arsenals. But where privacy arguments can devolve into a whining, "Leave me alone!" And even equal protection can't help but call to mind the often satirized lament, "Why can't we all get along?" Freedom of speech has a much more upbeat and affirming watch cry.
Express yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes at you from WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are either mine or Paul Siegel's. Free weekly email newsletter on request. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com, and ciao.